from runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Carl Franklin announcing show number 22 with guest Charles Betts, recorded Tuesday, August 21st, 2007. Run As Radio is produced each week by Plot Productions, offering professional media and podcasting services online at www.pwop.com.
Hi, you're listening to Run As Radio, and I'm your host, Richard Campbell, and here with my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, everybody.
So, here we are again, show number 22. And I got one announcement, really, which is that Barcelona's good to go. We're going to Tech Ed Barcelona.
Looking forward to it.
And that's the IT Forum Week, November 12th to 16th.
Right. So so it's interesting the way that – this is new for me, by the way, is that they have the IT Forum that week, but they also have the Developers Forum, right, which is actually the week before, the 5th through the 9th of November.
Right. So they split up the show. Really could give more space so they could have more attendees because
sure.
Venues are only so big. You were with me when we went to Tech Ed US where the venue is enormous. But
right.
Even then, I think they're out of room too. It's time to split that week.
Oh, those weeks a pretty up enormous, too. Pretty enormous show. Yeah. So the 12th through the 16th of November, 2007 is where we will be.
And they're absolutely certain it'll sell out. It'll sell out again, just like it did last year. So if you're going to go, sign up soon.
So, you know what might be a good idea, Richard, is let people know some of the stuff that we're doing there and some of the things that we know about.
Right. Well, we're doing the big thing, I think, is Speaker Idol. So
yeah.
We're going to be the hosts for the Finding a New Speaker contest at Tech Ed IT Forum. And you can go to the website there and sign up for Speaker Idol. They're looking for more contestants. And we'll be there. We'll be nice because we don't have to judge.
Right. So there's a website. Let me read this one. It's HTTP, blah, 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 mseventseurope.com/TechEd. And if you go there, there's a nice little flash links and stuff there, but you can click over to the Tech Ed IT Forum or to the developer side, whichever one you're interested in, or both. And then you get all the goodness that goes along with the
right.
Sign up and information.
And once you're on the IT Forum page, under community, there is a link for Speaker Idol. So if you're interested in participating in Speaker Idol, you can sign up that way.
Right. So one more time, MS Events is msevents.europe.com/TechEd.
Great. And over on our sister show, .NET Rocks, we're running a contest in relation to the Tech Ed Europe conferences. So you can drop in at .NETRocks.com and take a look at the contest.
And win $1 million.
No.
No?
How about a 24-inch LCD monitor, though?
That's kind of sweet.
Well, I thought it was a thing that everybody wanted. So when we were trying to figure out a prize, we went for the big monitor.
Nah, that sounds cool. I could actually use a couple of those.
Couldn't we all?
Yeah.
All right, let's get to the show. Okay, Greg, let's introduce Charles. Charles Betts is a senior enterprise architect and chief architect for IT service management strategy for a U.S.-based Fortune 50 enterprise company with a $1.3 billion IT budget. He is the author of Architecture and Patterns for IT Service Management, Resource Planning, and Governance, Making Shoes for the Cobbler's Children, by Morgan Kaufman, 2007. He has held architect's positions for Best Buy, Target, and Accenture, specializing in IT governance, ERP systems, enterprise application integration, metadata, and configuration management. He holds a Master's of Science in Software Engineering from the U of MN. MN is Minnesota?
Yes, it is.
He is Foundation certified in ITIL and is an ITIL V3 reviewer. I'm going to tease you about that. He is an active member of the professional community belonging to the IEEE, the ACM, the ITSMF, and DAMA, that's the Data Management Association. Charles lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota, with his wife Sue and son Keen. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you.
So we're talking some of the biggest IT organizations out there. I mean, a $1 billion budget is nothing to sneeze at.
That's big stuff.
Yeah, and that's only the central IT spend. If you count in all of the money that is spent across the enterprise is probably north of $2 billion.
But oh, my goodness.
That's wow. Comparable to a lot of the big organizations out there. I was talking with somebody, believe in the military aerospace sector, and their IT spend was somewhere around $3 billion. You start talking numbers like this, you're talking IT capabilities that if they were spun off into their own companies, they would start at Fortune 600.
Yeah. I mean, wow. It's, the division could be a major company all by itself.
Absolutely.
It's hilarious.
Sounds like in a highly complicated and large IT environment, certainly there must be challenges that you've experienced in how you actually put that together and how in the world you make it work.
Well, absolutely. And going with the Fortune 500 analogy a little bit more, what's ironic about enterprise IT is that it is the least automated major business capability in the modern enterprise.
You know, I can't argue with you that at all. It is just like your book says, it's shoes for the cobbler's children. We spend all this time putting together automation for the staff,
yep,
and for the line. We don't do it for ourselves.
We run it on Access databases and Excel spreadsheets. And I'm sorry, but by the time you get to an IT budget that big, you are dealing with information problems that are comparable to the supply chain and logistics management problems of any Fortune 600 company.
Right.
Sure. Yeah, IT as an enabler is quite often focused on the business process and what does the business need to run, but not a whole lot of enablement focus always on the IT organization itself.
Exactly. And I was very disappointed a few years ago to discover that the whole thing about the frog and the boiling water is a myth. It was debunked on Snopes.com. And
the frog actually, jumps out.
Yeah.
Frogs jump out of boiling water. They're smarter than us. But it's still a great metaphor because a lot of IT organizations are like that proverbial frog. You know, you are focused on supporting the customer's needs. And when you were a $10 million IT shop or a $50 million IT shop, yeah, your best people could keep it all in their heads.
Right.
You start getting into real problems of scale, you need systems that are every bit as robust and sophisticated as a modern supply chain management system, and yet we're just not there as an industry in having that level of understanding in general. That's where ITIL comes in.
Right, and this is the Information Technology Infrastructure Library.
Yes, exactly.
So what is that? There's a name that, without a real description, I think it's kind of hard to get your head around.
Yeah, especially because of it has two troublesome words in it. It has technology in it, and it has infrastructure in it. And so people start to think that it's very, very much a technically focused kind of set of concerns.
Right.
When really ITIL is especially in the current version, a very comprehensive and systematic approach to the business of IT. And in fact, it is not tightly coupled to any particular technology. I'm fond of saying that in 30 years, in 50 years, we may be all on optical quantum computers and Ethernet is a relic of the historical past and nobody even remembers what Unix stands for anymore. We will still need the ITIL processes of incident, problem, and change management. We will still be managing portfolios of technical services.
So this sounds like a foundational approach to, you know, what's the foundation that you build your business upon, so to speak.
Exactly. And if we consider IT as a business, it absolutely is a foundational approach. It is related to a larger concept called IT service management. And let's just talk a little bit about the distinction here.
Sure.
ITIL is a brand owned by Her Majesty's government.
Oh, because this thing started in the UK.
Yes, it did. And it is owned by a group called the Office of Government Commerce, which is in some ways analogous to our government publications office here in the United States. The analogy is not exact, but many people might be familiar with the GPO. It's kind of a bureaucratic arm that publishes a wide variety of things. In some cases, it is simply reprinting the proceedings of the governmental apparatus. In other cases, it's actually taking on the content creation efforts. And that is what the OGC has done in the case of ITIL, as well as some other examples of IT guidance, such as the PRINCE2 project methodology and some related material that is available for program management and software engineering. So as part of this overall portfolio of what they call their best practices guidance, they have created something called ITIL, Information Technology Infrastructure Library. It is now in its third revision. And for those who wish to see more about the details, it's fairly well documented out on Wikipedia about who the key players were and what the time frames were. I don't know that it's necessary to go into all that here.
So just go to wikipedia.org and search for ITIL.
Isn't that where everything is?
And of course. You'll see some overlap. There is an ITIL V2 article, which is kind of the main article. There is no ITIL V1 article. And there is the beginnings of an ITIL V3 article, which is kind of indicative of, you know, some of the issues you run into with Wikipedia, kind of different concepts of how you should structure the articles. But in any event, the history is all out there. And ITIL, from the start, I want to emphasize, has been a set of guidance that has targeted all of enterprise IT with three notable exceptions, as I mentioned before. ITIL does not cover project management per se, leaving that to the PRINCE2 guidance.
Sure.
It does not cover program management. There is a separate, smaller OGC volume on that. And it does not cover software engineering, which has been left, right, in the case of the OGC, to something called SSADM. But everything else of concern to the large IT shop has been covered in some way, shape, or form in ITIL through all three versions. Now, there have been some curious gaps and things have fallen into and out of scope. For example, data management. Data management as a practice area was given a very robust and detailed volume in the first version of ITIL, ITIL V1, an excellent set of guidance on data management. Then in ITIL version 2, for reasons unknown, they simply got rid of it completely, and so ITIL V2 had this big gap. In ITIL V3, they restored it as a practice area, but only gave it one section of a chapter in one of the major ITIL books. So some of the major practice areas kind of come and go as fashions change and as the industry has evolved. But nevertheless, you can go all the way back to ITIL version 1. You can see guidance on large-scale questions of vendor management and overall IT strategy and how you actually formulate the IT-to-business relationship, all of these kinds of things. And so one of the point being here is that one of the common mistakes with ITIL is that people will say it's only about IT operations. It's just about the people in the data center, in the trenches, wearing the pagers, responding to incidents and problems. Now, it's true that that group of staff has been, in some ways, the most eager to embrace ITIL.
Right.
Because they have needed this kind of a framework. And in particular, since ITIL doesn't cover project management or software engineering, the community of software developers, you know, kind of your lead technologists, your architects, have tended to see ITIL as, you know, perhaps not as relevant to them. But there's no question that if you look at ITIL, you see all kinds of things that are of great architectural significance. You see discussions about non-functional requirements, what it takes to have an application engineered so that it is has a suitable availability profile.
Sure, high availability, scalability, and things like that.
All of those requirements are fairly well stated in ITIL, and ITIL, I recommend it highly to anybody who's a software engineer in a large-scale enterprise context, and it doesn't have to be a capitalist enterprise. It could be a large nonprofit or a governmental organization as well.
ITIL is broken up into, forgive me if I'm not using the right term, feel free to correct me, but different domains.
Well, yes, it certainly has a structure. Any set of guidance this big wouldn't work without a structure.
Sure.
The structure between version 2 and version 3 is radically different. This has been a cause of some controversy in the industry. Personally, I think that the structure in version 3 is superior in general to the version 2 structure.
Now, the V2 structure is still the main thing people are using. V3 is literally just coming out now.
Yes, and the interesting thing about V2 is that there were two major volumes. There was a volume called Service Support and a volume called Service Delivery. And those two volumes, when people say they're doing ITIL, 98% of the time, everybody you talk to who says they're doing ITIL, they are talking about the so-called blue and red books, service support and service delivery, right, of ITIL V2. There were eight actual ITIL volumes. There was planning to implement service management, software asset management, security, application, and two volumes on the business perspective. Now, and I'm actually looking at them on my shelf, and I'm trying to remember if I've loaned one out. Oh, right, there was one called ICT, Information and Communication Technology. That was the missing one.
Right.
So there was nine V2 volumes, and yet only the red and blue books. I mean, when I say I'm foundation certified in ITIL, that means that I had basic training in the red and blue books. None of the other books were in scope. Now, I think that the ITIL thought leadership recognized that, you know, this is kind of an issue. You know, people are only gravitating towards two books of this significant library, and those are the two more operationally concerned books, especially Service Support, which deals with incident and problem and change management and related concerns that are very operational, are very data-centric, data-center-focused. And hardly anybody is going out and looking at the ITIL business perspective volumes, which were credible efforts in that domain. Certainly not the last word, but very credible efforts, and I do recommend them. So ITIL version 3 completely redid things. The library, all five volumes were released all at once, which was one of the problems with ITIL version 2, is that the volumes kind of dribbled out over the years. In fact, the Business Perspective Volume 2 only came out a few months before ITIL version 3 was released.
Ouch.
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, they had this long, long horizon of this guidance, kind of, another ITIL volume, and, you know, people just kind of lost interest, I think. Now, with ITIL V3, you've got this large, set of guidance. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
That was the ITIL version 3 library hitting the desk. That was the 2,000-page thump. And it all came out at once. It is generally of very high quality. I would say generally it's world class. I have some quibbles with parts of it.
And you have been a reviewer for it.
Yes, I was a reviewer on service strategy. I'll tell you, one of my quibbles is that they got into the issue of value chains versus value networks and make a claim in there that value networks are superior to value chains, which I take theoretical exception to. I think it's a bit of jumping on a fad bandwagon, but that is, you know, a minor caveat. Most of the material is of extremely high quality and written by very qualified individuals in their fields. So
it's an active, this is an active and growing and always changing set of standards.
Well, it's hard to, no, I can't really agree with that. I mean, ITIL V3 is released, and I don't know if they're even beginning to plan what ITIL V4 would look like. I doubt that it will come out, you know, for years. I think what it is there may be some complementary guidance that kind of evolves over time.
Sure.
But we are going to be, you know, dealing with and using the ITIL V3 volumes for many, many years now, and there's a whole ecosystem of training providers that are trying to reassess now how they're going to make a play with ITIL V3, which gets into some really interesting issues, because the current ITIL training ecosystem is very operationally focused. It's very much about supporting the operations folks, supporting the help desk people, supporting people who are struggling with incident, problem, and change, all at the operational level. Now, here comes ITIL V3, and it starts off with the service strategy volume, which really is targeted towards the chief information officer, the senior program managers, the senior IT vice presidents, and the senior enterprise architects.
Sure, more the management and senior management type of people.
Yeah, and the thought leaders, the strategists. And so the struggle for, I think, a lot of the current ITIL training organizations is, well, you know, if we're going to start saying that we're supporting all of ITIL V3, how on earth do we start to develop a capability for conducting training when previously we've been recruiting from people who are, say, data center process experts. We've, you know, we've looked for people who've revamped help desks or implemented an incident problem management process, and now we need to find people who know portfolio management up and down. And that's not been an area where we've made any connections or have, you know, really any history in recruiting instructors, nor do we have any track record in selling work and selling training. From the CIO's perspective, you know, and from the project office, program office perspective, are they going to send their senior program managers to ITIL training? ITIL has an image of being an operational framework.
Right.
A lot of people's gut reaction is going to be, why would you go to ITIL training? You're a program manager. And, you know, it's going to be a very, very tough row for them to hoe that the ITIL training is the way to go. Now, I'm not saying this is an impossible task, because there are some other players coming in. You start to see the interest of companies like Accenture and IBM Global Services.
Yeah, you're really trying to reach a new market here. But I got to think the core, whether V2 or V3, has got to be the guy on the ground, the help desk guy. That's where this problem started.
Yeah, it's they cannot neglect that market in reaching for new things. You know, it's you know, a basic marketing problem. I mean, if you overlook your core constituency, you may wind up with nothing. You may wind up having overreached. Now, that may not be the way, you know, of course, there's an interesting set of interests at play here. The Office of Government Commerce, as a you know, bureaucratic entity of the United Kingdom government, well, they want to do the best thing, and I'm sure that all the people there personally want to see ITIL succeed and prosper. But the United Kingdom has no financial or strategic interest in seeing ITIL become a successful global worldwide framework for IT governance. You know, the nominal or the putative reason for doing ITIL for the OGC is to give guidance to large-scale IT programs in the United Kingdom, right?
Right.
I mean, that is the mission of the OGC. They do not have a mandate to go out and solve the world's IT problems.
Yeah, anything beyond the UK is just not important to them.
Yeah, and you know, I need to be very clear, of course, that the individuals, I'm sure, you know, who actually were, you know, sponsoring this work, and the chief architect and all the rest, extremely passionate, extremely, you know, highly qualified. But, you know, the bottom line is that the success or failure of the ITIL training ecosystem in no way reflects on the success of the OGC. The OGC
Sure.
has done what it set out to do, and, you know, IT, you know, program managers within the United Kingdom, I'm sure, you know, will be strongly encouraged, if not told, that you will look to ITIL for, you know, for your guidance on IT governance.
And so do you see this as ultimately an issue with adopting V3, that the training organizations have sort of been left out in the cold?
I wouldn't say that they've been left out in the cold, and we're getting into some ITIL politics questions that I only have, you know, I would say somewhat passing familiarity with. There's a fellow called the IT Skeptic, www.itskeptic.org. Actually, he's unveiled himself. His name is Rob England. He's a fellow from New Zealand. I have great respect for him. He tracks these training politics a little bit more closely. And so anybody who really wants to get into the ins and outs of the ITIL training and certification, and how all that's going back and forth with the certification institutes, I'd suggest going to the IT Skeptic site. I've kind of been following it at a high level, but it gets a little too, I don't know, mundane.
Well, you're dealing with a he said, she said, ultimately.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, you get into all the questions of who gets to hold the keys to the kingdom and actually say that somebody is ITIL certified.
Sure.
I mean, you know, what is the process by which you can become an accredited training organization who can in turn accredit ITIL individuals' training? And so there's all, and that's where the real money is to be made. And of course, that's where all the politics are. And there's a company called APM, an outfit. I don't even know if they're technically a company, called APMG in play, and they have a privileged relationship now at the OGC, and this has led to some unhappiness with people who they may or may not have displaced, and that's the point at which I'm following it, and I just kind of lose interest, you know, in the details of it. And, you know, I just assume that they're all going to get it worked out sooner or later.
How does someone get certified on this?
Well, you go, first of all, companies cannot be certified, and neither as a IT capability in a company like mine cannot be certified, and vendor products cannot be certified. Only individuals can be certified.
Right.
They are certified through taking training and then filling out for the foundation. It has historically been a multiple choice test, and then for the master's level certification, it has been a blue book style test, then a grade, you know, proctored and graded by an accredited agency. And so it is an individual certification effort. Now, for companies to be certified, that's where ISO IEC 20000 comes in.
Right.
Which is one of the real interesting developments on the horizon, and I keep asking people, anybody with an opinion, are the major, I mean, for example, let's say that the Securities and Exchange Commission decided that it was advisable for all companies, you know, with significant stock exposure, you know, all publicly traded companies, that it would be advisable for their IT capabilities to be ISO 20000 certified. That might be a bit far-fetched, but, you know, it's the kind of recommendation or guidance that could start getting driven down through governmental or regulatory channels.
Sure.
And, you know, it might start as a recommendation and eventually become a mandate. It might play out in terms of eligibility for governmental contracts. If you want to be a service provider to a governmental agency, if you want to actually provide application hosting for a governmental agency, you might need to be ISO 20000. There's all kinds of different ways that could play out. But the bottom line is that just as you go out in the first-ring suburbs of any large metropolitan area, you see the light manufacturing companies with their proud banners, we're now ISO 9001. You can now place that kind of a banner on your IT shop. And arguably, it says something meaningful about your IT capabilities maturity.
Right.
Similar to, as a company where I work, we've gone through the ISO 27001 certification for the security management system. And the ITIL, you know, compatibility, if you will, with ISO 20000 is, I think, really valuable. For the guy who's working on the line or who's managing the IT department, one thing I think we should do is sort of go back to a little bit nuts and bolts on ITIL. What I mean, for somebody who has never looked at ITIL, who is running and working in, you know, a moderately complex to complex IT environment, what are the real tangible, you know, put your hands on them benefits that I can gain from, you know, implementing all or part of, you know, the ITIL standards?
I think ITIL, for me, has its strongest business proposition for companies who are at a sort of tipping point, at that, you know, frog in the boiling water realizing he's in trouble stage.
Yeah. Is it getting hot in here?
Yes.
And is there a lid screwed on the top, or can I actually get out, right?
Right.
Right.
Right. You know, you're moving from a maturity level where you've had one or two bright people in your IT organization. You've had a lot of goodwill. You've had a talented team that is doing it through heroics. And this is the same conversation around the capability maturity model on the software development side.
Absolutely. Yeah. That it's exactly sounded like the CMMI moment.
Yep.
When can I get past the heroes
right.
and into guys who can work a regular day and still get their job done?
Right.
Exactly. And that's where ITIL comes in and adds just tremendous value. It helps with your vocabulary. It helps you understand that you need to distinguish between incident management and problem management. It helps you set the boundaries around what a correct and workable enterprise change management process is. It gives you this basic structural foundation and well, again, a vocabulary. That's where I found it the most valuable.
And that's far from a Fortune 50 type of company. We're talking even companies of 100 or even smaller could fundamentally
yes.
be in a situation where it sounds like that's where they're at. They could really benefit from this type of a standard.
Yes, and the paradox, you know, for the Fortune 50 or even the Global 2000, you know, even companies of any size, I've now experienced and seen ITIL initiatives in larger companies. And of course, the paradox there is that ITIL comes in and it's often presented with kind of a religious zeal. Unfortunately, it's got a little, you know, tinge of zealotry with it occasionally. And the irony is that most of the larger companies find that, well, we're already doing this. We've had a incident management process in place for 20 years. We wouldn't be in business if we hadn't been doing that. You know, we've been managing production change, you know, for 20, 30 years. And of course, as you dig into the historical precursors of ITIL, you see that, you know, you go back through ITIL V3, V2, V1, then something, you know, there was a set of something called the IBM Yellow Books that were authored by a fellow named Ed Von Schaich.
Right.
And then you go back from the Ed Von Schaich material into Richard Nolan managing the data resource function, and you find that concepts like change and problem management, you know, that there's documentary evidence of them going back nearly 40 years. And so there is really nothing new under the sun, and so large organizations with a long-running, you know, data function, a long-running MIS function in the old kind of archaic terminology, they get this stuff. And then there's been some other kind of competing or, you know, complementary works. There's the Harris Kearns Enterprise Computing Institute has a good set of literature on IT operations, and you know, they have volumes like IT production services, IT services, IT architecture, IT systems management, all, you know, kind of overlapping and you know, very complementary to ITIL. But again, there's nothing new under the sun. And so when somebody comes into a large organization that's a long-standing data center and says, let's do ITIL, you have to kind of pick and choose. Now, one organization I'm experienced in, you know, looked at it and said, okay, well, doing 90% of this, but we don't have a CMDB yet, and we don't have a service catalog yet. So those were actually some value-add things that ITIL brought even to a very large company.
So there is always a few elements here and there. What about the Microsoft Operations Framework?
You know, I have to plead a bit of ignorance with that. I've certainly have seen seen it referenced many, many times. I believe that it was drawn largely from ITIL, but driven down into more of a methodology, a little bit more tightly coupled to Microsoft's particular technologies, although I don't think it's completely platform-bound. It's not just a reinterpretation specific to Microsoft Windows, but it is a bit more of a you know, day-to-day, step-by-step recipe, I believe. But I've only glanced through it on the Microsoft, whatever's available publicly on the Microsoft website, so I'm really not the best person to ask about that.
Well, and I always got the sense that the MOF was really focused on a smaller enterprise, on a narrower solution. But I've also heard that ITL themselves put out a small-scale implementation guide, not that I've seen it.
They do. There is one. I've not seen it either. There is guidance for the smaller organization. And I would suggest it would start, I mean, even in the smallest organization, minimally, I would say that you need to have some core of configuration management. Might be simply a list of your servers. I would say you need some basis of portfolio management. So you need to be tracking your projects and your applications and services as master data, as referenceable lists. And you would need minimally change in incident and problem management. And I think if you had all that, perhaps along with service request management, you would start to be on the right track. I don't know that you would need capacity management, for example. That definitely comes into play in the larger organizations. Formalizing availability management, might not be a need to call that out specifically. So some of those more higher order things. Certainly IT financial management always bears some attention, but, you know, again, the question is as to what extent do you want to start, you know, looking at, you know, the more sophisticated ways to do it.
And in the end, what we're getting here is a group of documents that are really describing best practices or techniques, not specific to a technology, for executing on each one of these IT functions.
Yes, that is something that I do appreciate about ITIL is that it has a very strong platform independent bias. Now that's a tough tightrope to walk, and actually in the current version there are some sections that get fairly specific about technologies. They talk about the ins and outs of managing DBAs and managing middleware teams and so on and so forth, but it by no means dominates the guidance. I would say most of the guidance as I look at it is generally platform independent. Although, you know, that statement is contextual.
Yeah, it depends on how you're looking at it as to how that's going to apply.
Yeah.
I wonder, maybe, can you give some examples of it, whether it's from, you know, your own personal experience or those that you've seen of, you know, what have been the real business benefits of implementing, you know, ITIL in a company? When did, you know, the company that you work at, this Fortune 50 company, how long has it been operating under an ITIL framework?
Well, that's what I was trying to say before, and you know, just I need to answer that question, you know, fairly generally, is that, you know, what is it? What does it mean to operate under an ITIL framework? I mean, evidence of that is it's not clear even what that would mean. Sending people to ITIL training is one piece of evidence. Strictly adhering to the ITIL definition of incident and problem would be perhaps other evidence. But what about a company who calls problem incident and incident problem?
Sure.
Are they ITIL compliant or not? You know, because the definitions of those words have been in flux and there's been religious wars about it.
Yeah, just because you've messed with the glossary doesn't mean you're not handling your IT problems well.
Yeah, exactly. Now, on the other hand, if you're not doing anything to try and identify root cause of problems, and if you have no means by which to identify problems proactively,
yep,
then it probably could be said you're not really, you know, ITIL might have something to offer here. You can't say you're fully ITIL compliant. But then the parts of ITIL are still highly controversial. The concept of the configuration management database, that's actually my specialty. I came into the configuration management database problem area through an interest in metadata management. And I've been studying and working with these, the concept of the internal IT repository for many, many years now. And it is not an area where one could say that, you know, we've just brought in ITIL and we put in a CMDB and we're ITIL compliant and everything is good now, because there's very few examples of good practice with CMDBs and many,
sure,
many failures.
I guess when I think about success, it wouldn't necessarily be in being compliant or certified under ITIL. I mean, just personally, I have an IT director that works for me who is ITIL certified as an individual, and I know that he's been able to implement a lot of probably more formal practices as a result of that focus. And I think that the company, the business, has benefited from that in many ways. So I guess maybe if I ask a more specific question, when companies have their individual certified, or if they're, even if they don't, they just implement some of these practices, what's the low hanging fruit that they tend to, where are the big benefits? In other words, if a company is looking at ITIL as, hey, maybe we should take a look at this, what are some of the selling points that say, hey, it's worth spending time and money on doing this?
Got it. Well, one of the first that always comes up is availability. So by understanding change impact, by managing change formally, by, you know, actually formalizing the change management process, the argument is that you will improve your system uptime.
Sure.
And if you can, in turn, especially if you understand how much a major system outage costs you,
right,
then you can demonstrate hard ROI. I know one ITIL manager, and he might be a fairly privileged person in terms of having this kind of an environment, but his company, because of the peculiarities of their business model, understands to the dollar what a 1/3 second interruption in their core business processing engine costs,
yeah,
them.
Sure.
And an interesting number, 1/3 of a second.
Yeah. And
well,
so,
if you're running a lot of transactions per second, for example, maybe you're paid by the transaction, and that's how you make your revenue, 1/3 of a second could be a pretty big deal. But if you're,
yep,
paid by the transaction, it's not actually that difficult to quantify how much 1/3 of a second costs.
Right. And if you have a change, if you have a process, an IT process improvement effort that can make a credible claim to having, you know, reduced the average duration of outages from 2 seconds to, you know, half a second per,
sure,
you know, every 6 months or every month, you can say that, you know, the ROI on that effort was X. Now, many companies, though, it's much more difficult. What would an outage in a back office HR system cost?
Right.
Well, I mean, people can't go in and enter a new employee, but they probably can do other things until the system comes back up. So it's kind of an annoyance, but it's really hard to actually assess a cost to that outage. Now, one of the business cases for the configuration management database that we're discovering is really interesting and very poorly addressed in any consulting literature, consultant guidance, IT literature, is the reduction of redundant surveying of the IT environment.
So what does that mean?
Y2K was perhaps the best example. The pattern is a realization first that, oh my goodness, we have a cross-cutting IT infrastructure/systems issue. We need to remediate each and every IT system across the board. This is something that has to be handled by a dedicated project team.
And everything is high priority, of course.
Right. And so that project team, especially in the distributed world, goes through a data collection effort that I have now witnessed personally at least 10 times. And the consistencies are notable. The team will start by defining an Excel spreadsheet template. That Excel spreadsheet will typically be sent out to a wide cross-section of the IT service and application managers, and it will ask, what applications do you have? What servers are they on? What databases are they dependent on? And then a number of subsidiary technical attributes and criteria about the environment. And one organization I'm familiar with, there was actually 4 of these efforts that all were uncoordinated and all descended upon the application teams all at once. And that's where the brakes got put on. And this is not a data point from one organization, by the way. I've seen it multiple times in multiple places. And so the realization starts to dawn on people that, you know, even beyond the operational things, you know, things like availability, that, you know, when you start to get into thousands and thousands of applications and tens or even hundreds of thousands of servers, that's just data that is too big to be, you know, maintaining through ad hoc batch survey processes,
right,
which, by the way, are always terribly inaccurate because there's, you know, Excel is a lousy data management tool.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way to put data integrity constraints on it. People will type in whatever they feel like to get the thing off of their desk. And you wind up with poor data quality, and you wind up continually recollecting the same core information. A lot of it, in my experience, just revolves around the very simple data set, reference data set of an application portfolio, and having that application portfolio accurately related to all of the distributed hosts so that you know that for application A, it's supported by servers 1, 2, and 3. That is an exceedingly simple requirement to state. I present regularly in industry and ask audience of between 50 and 200 people how many have that in their shops. I rarely get more than 2 or 3 hands going up.
Yeah.
And my commentary is that if we can't even do that, then what hope do we have of, you know, the more ambitious aspects of things like CMDBs and dependency management?
Well, as you said at the onset, you know, the automation that we do tends to be toward what the IT customers are asking us to do. Very, very infrequently do we actually do a good job of automating and having really good business intelligence around our own systems.
Exactly. And this is indicative, but we're heading into regulatory environments where it's simply no longer optional. If you have a customer data breach, if you're named in a lawsuit, you can be compelled to come before court and disclose. You need to know what you have on your systems and where they are, what data is where, if you're going to comply with the regulatory provisions of the credit card providers.
Sure.
You need to know where that data is. You know, you need to.
I agree. I think like the PCI compliance and the payment card industry, credit card industry, and a bunch of other standards, private and regulatory, government regulatory, are certainly pushing toward that.
Yeah, and it's really not that hard. It's kind of on the same level as like other back office systems, and IT is a back office function like HR or finance. Well, HR has a baseline requirement of knowing who's on the payroll. Finance has baseline requirements expressed through things like generally accepted accounting principles. IT, because it's only 50 years old as an industry, has been able to kind of get away with not knowing just the basics of its own inventory. But that era is rapidly coming to a close.
Yep, if there's IP addresses out there where there's some host that's responding and you don't know what they are on your internal network, then that's a good example of, you might have a problem.
Guys, I think that's a good point for us to just drop right off there. You're right, this is growing and it's becoming a mature industry. We're gonna get regulated, so we better be prepared for it. The book is Architecture and Patterns for IT Service Management, Resource Planning, and Governance, Making Shoes for the Cobbler's Children.
Which is a great name.
Charles, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.